From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, a Stockton University student curates an art show honoring an early 20th century painter who happened to be her great-grandfather. It's an exhibit of prints and paintings by William S. Rice, who lived in Stockton and was a member of the California Arts and Crafts Movement. Also, we recall the life and crimes of Dorothea Puente, the notorious serial killer from Sacramento who died on Sunday, and folk rock singer-songwriter Dan Byrne. But first, Sacramento has raised the stakes in the battle over the Kings. The city yesterday warned Anaheim to stop negotiating with the team's owners unless Sacramento gets solid assurance that a huge loan to the Kings backed by the city is repaid. And one of the Maloofs, the family that owns the Kings, fired back, telling Sacramento to stay out of their business. Joining us with details and the latest is Tony Bijak, Sacramento Bee reporter. Tony, welcome back to Insight.
Hi, Jeffrey.
Well, the city of Sacramento, in its letter to Anaheim, was asking and hinting at and threatening all kinds of things. What's the bottom line? What does the city want?
They want the $77 million that's still owed to the bond buyers. The city loaned the Kings money in 1997, and most of that money is still outstanding. If the Kings leave, the Kings are supposedly obligated to pay the city back immediately, the $77 million they owe, and the city is worried that they may not.
Does the city have good reason to think that they might not get the money?
It's interesting. I talked to George Maloof, one of the owners of the Kings, last night, and he was just outraged that the city would send this letter to Anaheim, basically a threatening letter. He's saying that they're going to pay. If they were to leave Sacramento, they would pay, and it's ridiculous to think otherwise. The city has sort of been looking at the Maloof's financial situation, as reported in the papers, and wondering how strong they are financially, and I think it's that question about the Maloof's financial strength that causes them some concern about whether the Maloofs can pay back the loan.
This loan was set up in the late 90s, before the Maloofs owned the Sacramento Kings. It was the previous owner who borrowed this money, backed by the team. Now, I remember at that time that the city was saying there's no risk in this contract because we either get the money back or we get the arena and we get a stake in the team. Why is the city worried now? Surely they're covered in either eventuality.
Not so much because of the fall of real estate values. At that point, the arena was thought to be worth, I was around back then. I remember maybe around $55 million, and then you get a $20 or $25 million stake in the team, and you got yourself fully covered. But at this point, there's no telling who's going to buy that arena, who's going to buy that land, and for how much. The Maloofs themselves have asked the county assessor to revalue the land at more like $30 million. So if you had, $30 and $25 million, the city comes up with $55 million, but they would owe $77 million. So no, it's quite a financial turnaround, really.
And if the city were to inherit the arena, if the Kings were to leave town and did not repay the loan, they would be owning an old arena with no major tenant.
No, I mean the arena can house plenty of other events besides a basketball team, but the city's not in a position to be an arena operator. They don't know how to do that. So a question of do you hire a company to operate arena and hope that it makes money with other kinds of events besides the Kings? Do you try to sell it? Would anybody want to buy it? Who'd want to buy that thing? It's a real predicament. It's a potential predicament here.
We're talking about the escalating battle over the Kings. My guest is Tony Bijak, reporter at the Sacramento Bee. Why did the city of Sacramento send this letter to the city of Anaheim when their concern appears to be with the Maloofs?
They say they're going to send a letter to the Maloofs too today, and that letter is going to ask the Maloofs to put on paper that they will pay off the loan. So their concern is on both fronts. I think that what you're seeing here is the city of Sacramento positioning itself for a potential lawsuit to stop the move, at least stop the move if the city's not going to be paid back at $77 million.
What would be the basis for a lawsuit if the city of Sacramento were to sue the city of Anaheim? What would be the basis of a lawsuit just because of a financial agreement with the Maloofs?
The way you file lawsuits in California is you look at the California Environmental Quality Act. There, you know, when you do a major project or something that affects the public, you have to file environmental impact reports, and in those reports, you have to look at economic impacts. And the city, what the city can do is sue and say that Anaheim did not do an adequate job looking at the economic impacts on the city of Sacramento, and so that's an avenue to try to either stop the move to keep the Kings here or to force the Kings in Anaheim to be sure to pay back the loan, figuring if they pay back the loan, then the city would be less inclined to try to short-circuit the move to Anaheim.
Tony, perhaps you can't answer this question, but how could environmental legislation be used in an economic dispute between two cities over a sports team?
I don't know the answer to that question, but it is done. There is, blight is defined, I think, very broadly in California, and I may be going out on a limb here, but I mean, it could be defined as a job loss here in Sacramento, a loss of income for a number of people who are employed related to the Kings here. Today what we're going to do is try to understand more about how CEQA can be used to try to stop this move and how you can define blight and economic blight.
And this definition of blight, as some people will recall, is an issue in the state budget because Governor Brown wants to shut down a lot of redevelopment agencies, in part because of this flexible definition of blight that is used sometimes to justify redevelopment money. What about Anaheim? We've heard from one of the Maloofs in this matter a response to the city of Sacramento's threatening letter. What about the city of Anaheim? Have they said anything?
They yesterday and this morning have declined comment on the city's letter to them. However, they're going to have their moment this evening because their city council will be meeting and being asked to vote on whether they will issue $75 million in bonds to the Honda Center to use to remodel some aspects of the center and to give a loan to the Kings to come down. So at the council meeting tonight, it could be very interesting. I think you can have some, the council members may react to the Kings, I mean, excuse me, to the city of Sacramento's letter. I'll be down there, and I'm going to be looking for the mayor and the city manager to see what they have to say about this. What we hear is they expect to go forward. Not that they don't take the city of Sacramento's threat seriously, but I think I expect them to vote to issue the bonds tonight, and that is a significant step for them in bringing the Kings down there.
Now, the $50 million portion of that would be a loan to the Kings has got nothing to do with this debt the team has to the city of Sacramento. This would be to cover relocation expenses if the team were to move to L.A., to Anaheim.
Yeah, I mean, in the contract that's unsigned between the Kings and the Honda Center people, it says $50 million to go to the Kings as a loan for relocation. But relocation is another broad term. It's possible that they use that however they need to get themselves relocated. I don't know whether some of that could go towards paying off the loan here. They're expected that they may have to pay the NBA major relocation fees of $30 million or more, and fees to the two basketball teams that are down there for or infringing on their territorial rights. So they may have a lot of relocation expenses to pay.
We're talking about the escalating battle over the Sacramento Kings, which might or might not move to Anaheim. Tony Bijak is a reporter for the Sacramento Bee. He's covering this story. The letter from Sacramento to Anaheim in part asked Anaheim to stop negotiating with the Maloofs. Is that because the city is still trying to keep the team, or was that more of an opening salvo in an attempt to ensure that the city gets paid?
You kind of think it's the latter, and I say that because the mayor has been saying for weeks that he's almost basically said, oh, there's nothing we can do at this point to keep the Kings. He called it last week a slow death. And then one of his aides, Bob Graswitch, said there's even a mood of good riddance. So it's there's a strong strong sense here among a lot of people that the Kings are gone and that this effort is to save the city's investment in that loan. I think there's also a group of people here, fans and some others that are hopeful that, well, you know, any deal is not done until it's finally done, and potentially this Anaheim deal can fall apart. And if it does, the Kings then may be stuck here. So if the city can make a little infringe on the ability to get this deal done, maybe we do save the Kings.
The letter to the city of Anaheim was signed by John Dangberg, who's the assistant city manager, not the city manager, and not the mayor or the city council. Have we heard, the city manager, of course, as many people will recall, is an interim city manager, Gus Vina, and he's actually leaving in a couple of weeks' time. So I guess John Dangberg is the ranking member of the staff. But what about the mayor and the city council? Have they said anything about this? Did they authorize it? Did they order it?
That's a good question. I think you got it right, is that this was essentially a letter from one city manager to the next. It was, but in our case, Gus Vina is stepping aside, so John Dangberg has been the chief, the main person at City Hall working on this. No, you noticed that this was not signed by the mayor. It was CC'd to the mayor. Kevin Johnson came out with a statement yesterday that was very vague, just saying he's going to work forcefully to make sure that we keep our we're made good on our investment in the loan. The mayor has a press conference this afternoon at 1 o'clock where he's going to talk about an arts program of his, but you can be sure that the news media there, we have a reporter going there, and all we have to ask about is just where does the mayor stand on this right now. The mayor's been silent for a few days. He hasn't returned our phone calls for a few days.
There's another significant person CC'd on this letter from Assistant City Manager John Dangberg, and that is Daryl Steinberg, who is a state lawmaker representing Sacramento. But he's more than that. He's a Senate President pro tem, arguably the most important, most powerful lawmaker in the state government. Have we heard from him? Does he realize that he's been invoked, at least indirectly, in this threatening letter from Sacramento to Anaheim?
Yeah, he realizes. The city's talked with him, they're a little vague on just how firm he is involved in this, but they're looking for him, or basically expecting him to see if there's something that can be done at the legislature some legislation that could block this move, or at least protect the city's investment in the loan. So we'll see today, and we're going to be talking with him today about what he sees that he can do in the legislature, and and how political is that going to get when he has to get a budget passed, and some of these Southern California legislators are going to have to be, he's going to have them on his side for that. So it's a little bit of dancing on the wire for Daryl Steinberg there, I think.
No doubt. He's got a few other pressing matters on his mind. And as you pointed out, a tussle between Sacramento and Southern California could actually have political implications for his arm twisting in the legislature.
Yeah.
Tony Bishak, Sacramento Bee reporter. You're going down to Anaheim tonight. We look forward to reading your report after this evening's City Council meeting there. And thanks so much for this update on Inside.
Okay, thank you, Jeffrey.
That's Tony Bishak, reporter at the Sacramento Bee. You're listening to Inside. When we come back, the life and crimes of Dorothea Puente, the serial killer from Sacramento who died at the weekend. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Could you balance the state budget in an hour on live radio? We plan to do that on Insight. We need a few regular folks to step up who are willing to do that. Seems like people think it's a good idea, but not a lot of volunteers yet to actually step up and do it. So if you'd like to do that or would at least like more information, you can communicate with us via our Facebook page, or you can email us insight@capradio.org. Coming up and talk Talk of the Nation, President Obama says the mission in Libya is clear and focused, but critics say both the goal and the way out are ambiguous. Reaction to the president's speech last night. Also, how people rationalize extreme violence like the Holocaust. Author David Livingston Smith says it starts with a simple thought that another person is less than human, and he says that paves the way for atrocity. Speaking of atrocity, one of America's most notorious serial killers died on Sunday. Dorothea Puente was 82. She was sent to prison for a series of murders she committed at her Sacramento boarding house. We spoke yesterday afternoon with a reporter who actually spent quite some time with Dorothea Puente in a series of jailhouse interviews he conducted with her in late 2008 and early 2009. He's Martin Kuz, and he wrote an in-depth profile of Puente for Sacktown magazine. When I spoke with Martin Kuz, I asked him when he last saw Puente.
It was in the first half of 2009. It was the last of a half dozen prison interviews that I had done with her, which were the first interviews that she had done since she had been taken into custody. She had done one brief interview on a plane flight back from Los Angeles to Sacramento after she had been arrested with Channel 3's Mike Boyd, but then ever since had maintained a public silence. And so I had the opportunity to sit down with her in prison. After writing to her, she assented to my request to talk with her. And over the span of several months, we had these half dozen interviews, and the last of which was during, like I said, the first half of 2009.
Well, she died on Sunday of natural causes. I haven't been able to find anything more specific than that. What was her physical condition when you saw her?
As I had noted in the article, she actually looked quite good. She seemed to have certainly all of her physical faculties. She had lamented of various health problems, which was something that she had done before she ever went into prison. She was notorious for claiming all kinds of health problems, particularly cancer. People who knew her said that every time they would see her over the span of, say, a year, she would reference having brain cancer one month. A few months later, it might be some sort of skin cancer. The next time, it might be bone marrow cancer. I guess the irony in all of this was that a few months ago, prison officials had said that she had taken ill and that it was, in fact, cancer that she was battling. I don't know for certain that that was ultimately the cause of death, but a few months ago, when that report came out that she was ailing, cancer was what was cited.
And she was 82 when she passed away, which is a pretty good age, especially for someone who's spent quite a lot of their latter years in prison.
You know, she, and I think that was something that frustrated the relatives of her victims. One gentleman in particular I know felt that her every living day was a denigration of his mother's memory. In the case of his mother's death, she was not convicted for that particular alleged murder. She was accused of killing nine people, ultimately convicted of killing three. But this gentleman's mother was one of the six for which she was not convicted. And I think that really grinded on the psyche of some of the relatives who felt that she had, in a sense, eluded justice and that she was living out her life in prison. When I visited her, she certainly struck me as someone who was lonely, even as she seemed to have the respect, if you will, of other prisoners at the Chowchilla Women's Facility. But in terms of her, in terms of her health, she had, spent 20 plus years behind bars, and like I said, actually looked quite good for a person her age.
I'm talking with Martin Kuz, former senior editor of Sacktown magazine, and a couple of years ago he wrote a story, an in-depth story for the magazine about Dorothea Puente, who passed away in prison on Sunday. You said that she had the respect of the other prisoners, at least that's how it seemed to you. Based on what? On her age, her notoriety, or something else?
I would say a combination of those things. A prison official that I spoke to during the course of the story said that she maintained a low profile in the sense that she didn't cause any problems. She was, in fact, a model prisoner. I think she only had one violation on her record during her time in prison. And But yet everyone was aware of her because of the notoriety of her crimes. She really goes against the grain in terms of the profile of a serial killer. First of all, being a woman puts her in the minority of serial killers, but then also her age. You know, she was very much regarded as this grandmotherly-like figure in the neighborhood that she lived in Sacramento. And I think to some extent that grandmotherly persona carried over to prison. I think other prisoners, from what I could tell when I visited with her in the visitor's room at the prison, you know, they kind of doted on her a little bit. They referred to her very affectionately as Miss Dorothea or Miss D. And there seemed to be an authentic warmth between her and the other prisoners. And I'm sure that some of that had to do with her sort of having kind of elder status, elder stateswoman status, if you will, in the sort of hierarchy of a prison. And also the fact that she was known for her cooking. She was actually able to cook in prison, and she was known for her homemade tamales and some other special recipes. And I guess that really curried favor with some of the other inmates. I think they probably liked having a little bit of home cooking, knowing probably that nothing bad could happen, as had happened with some of the victims who were supposedly poisoned by her with food that she served them or in their in drinks that she gave them.
Well, there is such a horrible irony there, isn't it, that she's so famous for poisoning people and yet people liked her cooking.
Right, and there was even a book put out a few years ago called Cooking with a Serial Killer that includes recipes of Dorothea Puentes. The author corresponded with her and compiled a list of her favorite recipes, and that aspect, I think, of her life and her crimes is, you know, you read something like Cooking for a Serial Killer, and I suppose it seems darkly comedic, but I think it's important to always remember that these were basically defenseless people that she preyed upon. You know, these were the homeless, the mentally ill, derelicts, and so there's that cartoonish aspect of her and her legacy, but the crimes were horribly real. During the course of reporting the story, I went through thousands of court documents and including crime scene photos, which showed victims in various states of decomposition. Mm. You see something like that. The kind of the gravity of the crime, the horror of the crime, makes something like Cooking for a Serial Killer seem almost offensive, because these were real people. As John O'Mara, the prosecutor, referred to them as, they were the shadow people. People didn't necessarily realize that these folks were missing or that they had passed away, and she knew that. She was very, very shrewd.
After all these years and with all the publicity given to that case, to her case, it's still shocking. Right now I'm looking at this photograph of Dorothea Puente, and it still just doesn't compute that someone who looks like this could have committed so many horrible murders for such an inadequate reason and have done it in such a bizarre way. When you met her in prison, did it seem to make any more sense when you actually met her face to face, or did it still look as bizarre that someone like this could have done that?
Well, there certainly is that incongruity between her appearance and her crimes. And when I met with her, what became almost immediately apparent was how disarming she could be, because she seems completely harmless. And she, I think, traded on that. I think she understood that people would see her as someone who couldn't possibly do anything untoward, let alone kill people. And yet, even before these crimes were uncovered, she had had a history of run-ins with the law and had been, suspected of drugging other people that she had cared for prior to the boarding house at 14th and F. But in person, she, for the most part, she came across as someone who seemed like the description that you always heard, the little old lady down the street. But there were flashes of a person who I think had some sort of mental condition. I think that there was a nefariousness that would occasionally come out. When I pressed her in that last interview on whether she had committed these crimes, And she used an expletive in the response that that she gave me. But she said, you know, I don't give a blank what anyone thinks about me. Moment when I thought, okay, you know, that's not the little old lady down the street. That's something else. And that was part of her personality. But she was so adept at concealing that that very, very few people suspected that she could be anything other than this kindly, grandmotherly-like figure.
Finally, Martin Kuz, you were a senior editor of Sactown magazine when you wrote the piece about Dorothea Puente. You're going to be leaving Sacramento very soon. Where are you going and what are you going to be doing?
I am moving to Germany to work for the paper Stars and Stripes, for which I will cover the war in Afghanistan. So it's presents an enormous opportunity for me, but the opportunity wouldn't be possible if I can, you know, give a slight plug here to Sactown Magazine. Rob Turner and Alyssa Lee, the co-editors, are so gracious in the opportunities they've given me and everything that I've learned here and the opportunities to do the stories that I've had the chance to do over the last few years presented this possibility with Stars and Stripes. So I will certainly miss getting the chance to work with them. And Sactown has really been just, I think, a terrific opportunity to write stories like the profile of Dorothea Puente. That was the kind of story that I see other publications attempting to do. So I give my plug to Sactown and say that I think it's a really, really great publication and terrific for Sacramento.
So you'll be based in Germany, but reporting on the war in Afghanistan. So I assume that means that you will be spending time in Afghanistan with troops.
That's right. The bulk of my time will be spent with troops in Afghanistan. Germany is where the paper has a bureau, but most of the time you are, as a military reporter, you're going to be embedded with troops in Afghanistan for stretches of, say, 6 to 8 to 10 weeks. And so that will be my beat, so to speak, is I will be spending that time in Afghanistan. And this is the time of year when the fighting tends to pick up, usually spring and the summer months. So I'll be going right into the middle of it as this war continues to push on and as the U.S. attempts to bring some sort of stability, impose some sort of stability on Afghanistan.
Well, an exciting opportunity and a great professional opportunity, but you could be excused for feeling a little nervous, too.
People have been concerned for my welfare. They've been very, very gracious in that respect. Certainly, that's an aspect that you can't disregard. It's foolish to not be aware of the consequences. But I think that this is such an important story and one that can't be covered enough. It's a war that's been going on for many years now, 10 years, and sometimes it can slip off, I think, the radar of the national consciousness. I don't think that makes it any less important. And so, you know, if there's any infinitesimal risk to me, it pales compared to what you see the service members doing who are actually the ones out there attempting to fight this war. So the nervousness on that people have showed has been really, really kind, but I just feel that it's too important of a story not to attempt to chronicle.
Martin Kuz, formerly of Sactown magazine, he wrote about Dorothea Puente for the magazine a couple of years ago, who passed away on Sunday. He's going to Germany soon, where he'll be reporting on the war in Afghanistan for Stars and Stripes. Martin Kuz, thanks for joining us. Good luck, and stay safe.
Thanks so much, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, a Stockton University student curates an art show honoring a painter who happened to be her great-grandfather. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow, Tahoe's native fish population has fallen considerably. A researcher who's studying that explains. Also, would you go undercover in a drug bust to save your addicted son? You'll meet a Roseville man who did that. A Stockton University student is curating an art show honoring an early 20th century painter who happened to be her great-grandfather. It's an exhibit of prints and paintings by William S. Rice, who lived in Stockton and was a member of California's arts and crafts movement. The curator of the exhibit, William S. Rice's great-granddaughter, is in our studio, Marie Claire Treseder, along with her father, Carl Treseder, a grandson of William S. Rice. Marie Claire, Carl, welcome to Insight.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you.
Marie Claire, how did you come to curate an exhibit of your great-grandfather's artwork?
Well, it's sort of an exciting story for me. 5 years ago, I visited UOP as a prospective student, and I met with a professor, Dan Kasser. He carved out 3 hours for me on the spot, and by the end of it, we'd planned my senior show. So it sort of followed like a fantasy and continued exactly as planned. So we've gone forward with the family on the project.
Are you an art student?
Yes. I'm a double major in philosophy and visual studies with a minor in gender studies.
How important was your great-grandfather's work, William S. Rice's work, in your family as you were growing up?
Oh, it was absolutely pivotal. I grew up all around his artwork. It covered my walls. It was in my bedroom. And so it inspired me from an early age to pursue the rather difficult career, oftentimes, of following the arts.
Yeah. What about you, Carl? When you were growing up, how important was William S. Rice in the family?
Very important. My grandfather, in the latter portion of his life, lived in Oakland. I grew up in Santa Clara County nearby, spent regularly time with my grandparents growing up, visiting them, and even spending some time in his studio, hearing his stories about his earlier career and his coming to California and his great love of California landscapes.
What kind of person was he, William S. Rice?
Well, he was a teacher, first and foremost. He came to California in 1900 to teach in the Stockton Public Schools. He was an art teacher there. In his vacations and spare time, he traveled around California sketching, painting, photographing, and improving his art skills. He had a professional education in Philadelphia, in art school. He was a Pennsylvania native, and he was a working artist when he got here, and he worked for the next 40-some years here in California, teaching by day and doing his art holidays, weekends, and evenings with his family.
Marie Claire, that was a long way for him to go from Pennsylvania to Stockton. Why Stockton?
Well, he was actually offered a position there through his friend Frederick H. Meyer, who is the creator of the College of Arts and Crafts in California. So it was an impressive offer for him at the time. And so he took it, moved there without knowing a soul, and became the art supervisor for the Stockton district.
We're talking about the late artist William S. Rice, most famous for his years in Stockton. There's an exhibit of his work. It's titled Valley Impressions at University of the Pacific. It's curated by one of Rice's great-granddaughters, Marie Claire Treseder, who is a senior at University of the Pacific. She's with us with her father, Carl Treseder. Marie Claire, how would you describe the kind of art that William S. Rice specialized in?
Well, there are two types of mediums he worked in proficiently. There was both watercolors and woodblock prints. And so I set up the show with this in mind, and I have two separate rooms. So one work, the watercolors are set up in one room, and then the woodblock prints are set up in the other. And he's most famous for the woodblock prints as of late. The Japanese show at the Legion of Honor most recently held his work. And so those works are sort of in vogue right now. But
yeah, you know, I was looking at photographs of Rice's work and thinking, well, it looks somewhat familiar. And then I realized it's probably because I saw his work at the Japanesque exhibition in San Francisco, which was a tremendous exhibit. That was tied in basically with the exhibit of Impressionist works from the Musée d'Orsay. Mm-hmm. And it was about the impact of Asian art on Impressionist era artists. Carl Treseder, can you tell us more about the specific impact of this Asian influence on artists like Rice? How did it show up?
There was a book published about a year ago about my grandfather's color block prints by Pomegranate Press here in California. My mother, his daughter, wrote the text to the book. And in it, she points out that I'm going to say about 1916, not sure about the date, an exhibition of Japanese art at the in San Francisco, including prints, attracted a lot of attention among California artists and the public. And so there was a great, might say, visibility to that artwork. And he and other artists were really moved by and studied both the technology and the styles, the perspectives, the medium that block printing very seriously thereafter. And he pursued a career in block printing extensively, published books about how to do it, and taught it.
Well, there's one of those prints in the front of the brochure for this exhibit, Valley Impressions, and it's from 1925. It's called Apple Blossom Time. Marie-Claire, I'm hardly an expert in art, but it does appear to have an Asian quality to it, a Japanese quality to it. Is that correct?
Absolutely. He was incredibly inspired by that work, and he fused it as sort of a international artistic expression.
And what about the arts and crafts movement? Because he's considered to be part of that, too. Is that correct? And what does that mean?
Well, the arts and crafts movement sort of specialized in prodigious labor. So woodblock prints, especially, are a difficult medium, requiring tons of hours of effort for every piece that he produced. And he would also chisel each work himself. And so the traditional Japanese technique is called yukoi. And they would often, the Japanese artist, would paint the portrait and send it off to their assistants to have them carve it. But he did all of those himself. So the emphasis in the arts and crafts movement is on individuality, but also labor. And so that is absolutely present in his work.
Carl Treseder, what did you say when you heard that Marie-Claire, your daughter, was going to curate a major exhibit of William S. Rice's art at University of the Pacific?
It was just a great joy to see her carry forward this enthusiasm that so many people in my family share. One of my sisters was commissioned to produce a full book-length treatment of his career, and which will be published next year by Pomegranate Press.
So William S. Rice died in 1963, so that was well before Marie-Claire was born. any way to predict what he would make of this turn of events, that descendants he never knew would be honoring him in this way?
I don't think he'd be surprised, but I know he'd be delighted. His daughter, my mother, his son, William, one of his nephews, William Fitch, who lived here in Stockton, all studied printmaking and art, ceramics, taught it, did it. So he would have expected that his descendants followed the interest and not just like to look at the pretty stuff.
And Marie-Claire, did you learn anything personally or professionally about your great-grandfather when you were putting this exhibit together?
I have to say I did. It was a real experience for me once the artwork actually hit the walls and I took a step back and I realized how much my life mirrored his own, having also moved to the area, being stalked in as a young person in their 20s, pursuing a career in the arts, which was something that somehow eluded me until I put it really up there, that how similar our lives had been. And so that was a real familial connection for me.
Well, I can imagine. This exhibit, Valley Impressions, Historic Block Prints and Watercolors by William S. Rice, is at the Reynolds Gallery in the Jeanette Powell Arts Center at University of the Pacific in Stockton. The exhibit runs through April 5th. Marie-Claire Treseder, a senior at Pacific, curated the exhibit. She's great-granddaughter of William S. Rice. Her father, Carl, is grandson of William S. Rice. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, folk rock singer and political activist Dan Byrne.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. This afternoon on Capital Public Radio News, the latest in the dispute between Sacramento, Anaheim, and the owners of the Kings. That story and much more during All Things Considered from Capital Public Radio News. The folk rock singer-songwriter Dan Byrne is coming to town. He's playing at Harlow's in Midtown Sacramento tonight. He's been recording for many years now. And most notably recently, or one thing he's done recently of interest, of note, was writing songs for the film Get Him to the Greek. He joins us by phone. Dan Byrne, welcome to Insight.
Thanks. Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's start off by listening to one of your songs, just so people can get a flavor of what you do if they're not familiar with you. From the album Anthems, this is Revolution Begins in the Basement.
Too soon, baby, too soon, too soon, too soon, baby, too soon, too soon. Some birds are born. Revolution, slag time weavers, revolution begins in the basement.
Dan Byrne, when you're writing your songs, do you typically start with the words or the music? Because it seems like the words are so fundamentally important to your music.
Well, I mean, they are, but I usually just start with an idea, and I think the words and the music are pretty much tied up together. So, you know, maybe I start with a word, but by the time I get to word four, there's some musical thing going on usually.
Yeah. What kind of music did you grow up with?
Well, you know, my dad was a classical pianist, so I grew up with that. But pretty early on, I had to sort of break away and find the things that I liked, which were, I guess, the Beatles, and then a whole bunch of solo old country and blues and folk singers that was easier for one person to sort of emulate.
Yeah. Listening to that song, Revolution Begins in the Basement, there is a kind of pop rock flavor to it, but a lot of your music sounds more unambiguously from the folk tradition. And here's one example from your latest album, Live in New York. It's the song Grandpa.
Hey, let's get married in the barn. I don't care what stall they put us in, but I want to go fishing with your grandpa, and your grandpa thinks we're living in sin. I don't care if the preachers catch us cooking.
That's live from in New York. Your previous album was live in Los Angeles. Why did you record two live albums in a row?
Well, it was, you know, I hadn't recorded a live album ever, and people had been asking me for some years to do one, and I finally did the Los Angeles one, and it was so fun that we decided let's do another one because we're going to be in New York, and I think I might do a whole series of them now. I kind of want to do Cape Town next.
Yeah. I was reading over what people have been saying about your music over the years in the comments sections of your records on Amazon.com. And one thing I saw a couple of times was people saying, you know, Dan Byrne's records are great, but he's so much better live. Is that part of the reason why you've made two live albums? Do you share that sentiment?
I don't. I think my records are great, but, you know, it's a whole different thing. A live show is a whole art in itself, and I mean, really, the challenge with these live records was to make them read like a record, you know, so that you're not feeling like you're on the outside looking in of something that you weren't there, and too bad you weren't there, but, you know, to sort of make it an experience of its own.
My guest is Dan Byrne, singer-songwriter. He plays Sacramento. He's at Harlow's in Midtown tonight, and then he's on to Chico on Wednesday and Berkeley on Thursday. You contributed some songs to the Russell Brand film, Get Him to the Greek. How did that come about?
Well, it kind of came on the heels of another movie that I worked on quite a lot, which was Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story. So, you know, that's sort of my second job now, I guess, writing songs for movies that have songwriters. It's a pretty fun gig, I must say.
Well, I can imagine. Were you given a specific assignment? In other words, we need a song this long for this part of the film, and this has just happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty specific. You're writing for a character in a specific context, in a specific style, usually. I mean, there's all kinds of wide open parameters, and you know, but you do get direction, and we like to get direction.
Yeah. Let's listen to one of your earlier songs from the album Dan Byrne. This is Jerusalem.
Here for yourself a while, and if you must put me in a box, make sure it's a big box with lots of windows and a door to walk through and a nice hot chimney so we can burn, burn, burn everything that we don't like and watch the ashes fly up to heaven.
You're from a Jewish family. What did your Jewish family think about you writing a song called Jerusalem?
Well, I don't know. I didn't really ask them, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
You know, they kind of did their thing, or I guess I kind of did my thing. You know, they were casually supportive, I guess. I guess they never certainly got in my way, so... you know, they kind of paved the way. My mom was a poet, and my dad was a musician. So I guess I sort of took the two and combined them and did my own thing with it.
And they both left Eastern Europe because of the impending Holocaust.
Yeah, my dad was from Lithuania and made it to Palestine, and my mom's family. Just got out, you know, a few months after Kristallnacht, so that was 39 also. Really lucky, you know. I'm always aware of how lucky I am.
My guest is Dan Byrne. You've written a lot of songs about very serious matters, political matters. There's a song you also wrote a long time ago, which seems more humorous and even a little outrageous. It's about Tiger Woods. And you wrote that a long time ago, long before the scandal, but it did seem to allude to sexual matters. Do you still do that song about Tiger Woods?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I always find it kind of amazing when there's a song and then events happen and it puts a whole new twist on the song. So that's kind of what happened with that one. It seems like every day somebody comes up to me and says, you know... Guess you don't wish you were Tiger Woods anymore. The song says that sometimes I wish I was Tiger Woods, but I guess I respond, well, you know, maybe I do more than ever now.
Yeah. Dan Byrne, singer, songwriter, he plays Sacramento tonight. He's at Harlow's in Midtown. Dan Byrne, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
That's Insight for today. We'll be back tomorrow. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver, Liz Cazares, Christine Guerra, and Susan Morar. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. new study has found a considerable decline of native fish species in Lake Tahoe since 1951. On the next Insight, we'll talk about what this means with the lead researcher. Plus, would you go undercover in a drug bust to save your addicted son? You'll meet a Roseville man who did. And Festival de la Familia will celebrate 20 years in Sacramento. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.